Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. Alrighty, welcome in everyone to Value Investing Live. We are happy to be here to kick off the new year with Vitaly Katsin-Nelson. Vitaly has a CFA designation and is the CEO of IMA, a value investing firm in Denver. Today we're going to run through some questions with him, but please feel free to post those questions as I do see some of you are already doing over there in YouTube. We will poke those in as we go through things and we'll hit on all of them once we get to the end as well. As always, do please say hi, let us know where you're viewing from. We love seeing those international audience out there joining us, and we're going to go ahead and jump into things now. So Vitaly, let's go ahead, start off, give us a little bit of background on yourself, where you came from, who you are, give us kind of the who, what, when, where, and so on.
Well, as you can tell by my accent, I was born in Texas. No, I was born in Russia. I moved to the United States in 1991, 30 years ago, in December. And when we moved to Denver, like, I didn't know what I wanted to do for a living. I was 18 years old. It took me a few years to figure out that I love investing. And once that happened, it was like a love, you know, at first sight. And I changed my major for the sixth and final time to finance. Got my undergraduate degree and graduate degree in finance. Got my CFA. And I did this while I was working actually for this firm, IMA. So I've been with IMA since 1997, believe it or not, well, you know, almost 25 years. And the I also taught investing at the University of Colorado, Denver for about 6 or 7 years. Then I wrote two investment books. The latest one was the Little Book of Sideways Markets, which came out in 2010. And I'm incredibly passionate about investing and value investing in general. So kind of as my partner, they may like to say, stocks are us. I'm a stock geek. So I love to analyze companies, you know, and just, let's say, investing to kind of over the years evolved into a hobby in the sense that I would be doing it if I wasn't paid for it. So that's kind of my life story.
Definitely. And so that kind of covers our, how did you get involved in it? Was there anything that inspired you right off the bat? I guess what sparked that interest to change your major for that final time and dive in?
Well, I think investing is a very intellectually stimulating exercise where, like, there's this quote by Seneca that I really like, and it's kind of, I think about it all the time. Time discovers truth. And if you think about it, right, it's you do all the research, you know, all the analysis, and then time will show you if you're right or wrong. Most of the time, sometimes there's randomness comes in, but overall. And so this is what I really like about it. It's just this constant intellectual puzzle. Also, if you're a generalist, this is one of those professions where I get to learn so much about so many different things. One day I may be analyzing a company that makes semiconductors. Another day I may be analyzing a company that makes, I don't know, like submarines. And so if you're an intellectually curious person, that is a perfect profession for you. And so that's, you know, that's a kind of a perfect marriage for me as well, you know, just intellectually curious, and it's, you know, and investing requires that too. So yeah,
definitely. And were there any, I guess, big name investors that initially caught your eye and that you kind of dove into to their line of work that helped you develop that interest?
I mean, So as a value investor, it's impossible, obviously, not to be influenced by Buffett and Munger. I think the Ben Graham's writing that kind of set the whole framework for value investing. I call it the six command. He created kind of the six commandments of value investing. And by the way, if your viewers are interested in this, we have a website called sixcommandments.com, and they can go there and just download a chapter I wrote like on this topic. And that basically spells out the basics about the kind of the investment, the principles, philosophical principles on value investing. But over the years, it's just, I've been learning from a lot of peers. I'm not sure I can point out, say, like, there's a lot of investors for whom I borrow some parts of their framework. And I think the one thing that makes us different from kind of from many other investors is that a lot of investors are, they focus on a very specific niche, meaning some are deep value investors, some are kind of growth, growth value investors. We are very eclectic. Like, I'll give you an example. On one side, we own a pipeline company, kind of an old boring pipeline company. On the other side, we own Uber. Okay. And both companies fit into kind of philosophical investment framework. Now, Uber would not be considered a traditional value company, but the way we look at it, it's a company that has a significant competitive advantage. It will be around in 10, 20 years from now. And it has, and we are buying today a significant discount to its fair value. So, so for us, you would not call it traditional value stock, but if it's significantly undervalued, that's why it's in our portfolio.
Definitely. Hear you there. So from here, let's dive in a little bit, as you hit on there, to that investing philosophy. Is there anything specifically that guides it? Obviously, we're all here kind of under that overarching value idea, but is there anything, I guess, any key tenets within there that you kind of latch on to, rely upon in that day to day?
Well, let's talk about the six commandments of value investing, right? If I remember them all, but just think about it. First of all, you treat stocks not as pieces of paper, but as businesses. The second you do this, you stop kind of, that's number one. We'll talk about it, speculating in a second. You have a long-term time horizon. The risk for you is not a volatility, but a permanent loss of capital. Mr. Market is there to serve you, and therefore not the other way around. Whenever you buy stocks, you look for margin of safety. I'm forgetting one or two more, but if you follow these principles, it's impossible for you not to be an investor. To become a speculator, right? It's impossible for you to treat market as just a gambling, a place where people come to gamble, which a lot of people do. So and that's how you become an investor. If you follow these principles, then you're basically will be acting as an investor. Yeah,
definitely. And from there, I guess let's go to kind of a day to day, actually jumping in there, finding companies, finding these investments. What does that look like? Kind of starting from the top at idea generation all the way getting into, managing the risk of a potential investment. What does that process actually look like for you?
It's a lot less structured, a lot less busy than you think. We own some more companies for years and years. A lot of our companies, actually, for years and years. The way my day looks, I get up early in the morning, about 5 o'clock. And I write for about 2 hours every single day. And that is my, I would call my superpower, in a sense that if I didn't write, I would not be able to focus. Like, it's very difficult for me to focus for a long period of time, but writing makes me focus. And that's how I think through writing. So that's I come to the office about 8 o'clock and I'm here until 4. And then I go maybe 4 or 5 o'clock. How do we look for ideas? The ideas come to us from very different places. You just have to be open to receive them, I guess. So we do screens. that's probably the least effective way of getting ideas, you know, especially in this market. I have a huge network of other value investors, and I talk to them on a regular basis. And this is where we get ideas from all over the world. We read a lot. So we have also over the years created watch list of stocks we'd like to own at, you know, different prices. So this is the source of ideas. And one thing important to understand that this is, you have to expose yourself to randomness. In other words, you have to expose yourself that it's not like you're going to get this one idea a month. Sometimes you just, you know, like, you know, you just don't have any good ideas. You know, either nothing comes to you, or the market is expensive and there is nothing, you know, there's very little, you know, that looks interesting. And so when we find a company, we ask ourselves a question, do we understand the business? And this is very important, because if I can't understand the business, I can't be rational. So if we can understand the business, if we can analyze it, then we move forward. And then if it, you know, then while we're doing this, if we discover that this is not really a high quality business, then we stop, we just move on and to something else. And then we, you know, if we are still on this journey of the business company, then we say, how much is it, you know, how much is it worth? If we can buy it at a discount to fair value, then maybe make it into our portfolio. If it's, we find that this business we want to own, but it's not cheap enough, we put it on our wish list. The way you control risk in this, basically, we control risk on the security level by basically doing two things. You buy quality businesses, and you make sure they're undervalued. Also, if you have a quality business that's growing earnings, then if you got the margin of safety a little bit wrong, in other words, if you overpaid for it a little bit, or you got, you know, you will get bailed out by earnings growth. Again, if you got the quality right. On the portfolio basis, we basically, we don't approach diversification the same way Noah was constructing his ark, and I'm quoting Buffett when he said that, where he tried to get two of each. What we're trying to do, we kind of, Seth Klarman said, we worry macro, invest micro. In other words, we think about risks, headwinds and tailwinds, global headwinds and tailwinds. And then we try to kind of, not the short term, but the kind of climate changing events. And then we try to adjust portfolio to either benefit from them or to make sure we don't get hurt by them. And that's kind of, and then we, you know, and then we try to make sure that we don't have the whole portfolio, you know, whole, all stocks exposed to one risk. So we want to, you know, this is how we look at diversification. We just want to make sure that not single event cannot, you know, kill our stocks. So,
gotcha, for sure. And thanks for that breakdown there. And you mentioned there opening yourself up to a sense of randomness for ideas kind of coming in. Is there any, I guess, limitations to your investable universe, or is there anything that you just absolutely wouldn't touch out there in the stock market?
Well, we like stock companies where business, there would be several that come to mind. Number one, businesses that we don't understand. Like, I'll give an example. If it's a biopharmaceutical company with one early stage drug, you need to be a PhD and understand biology much better than we do. So that would be an example, you know. Companies that are low quality companies, very deeply cyclical industries, we usually don't own. There are sometimes exceptions. And if there are exceptions, they're truly exceptions where you may have, like, I'll give an example, like we in the oil industry, like oil and gas industry, we would own a company that have royalty rights to revenues of other companies. Well, that's actually high return on capital business in not as such a, as in a low return capital industry. Also, there are some countries where we just don't feel comfortable investing. And China obviously comes to mind here. But also, our rule is basically if I, this is kind of a very simple rule. If I write an article, negative article about a company or about the country, and then I'm afraid traveling to the country after that, probably should not own stocks in the company, in the country. So like Russia, for instance, for me, would be out of bounds. So is China. And so we basically stay in countries where there is a good rule of law.
Gotcha. And from there, and I know there's plenty of questions you're rolling in kind of on this note as well. A lot of our audience, a lot of times, they like to pick your brain regarding specific metrics and jumping into valuing a company. Are there any kind of key ones that you like to reply, that you like to kind of use on a day-to-day basis, or does that change over time?
Okay. Let me try this analogy on you. Okay. And this is coming from a person who knows very little about carpentry. Okay. But let's say you're a carpenter, right? And you're probably going to use a different tool to make a table than to make, a deck, right? So you have different sets of tools. So for, like, when you analyze a bank, like, say, book value is a meaningful measure because the book is actually, bank's book value is calculated every quarter. If I analyze software company, book value is meaningless. So for every industry, the tool is going to be very different. And therefore, you just need to understand what matters for that industry, for that company. So I hope I answered that question. But if you analyze a software company, probably how much you pay per subscriber matters a lot. The bank, that's a different type of business. So it's different analysis done. So.
Definitely. So it sounds like there's not necessarily one specific metric that you're replying on. It's more of a
fluid. But I think one thing is universal, which is not a hard metric, but a soft metric, management. As I got older, I started to appreciate how important the management is. Like when you are a young analyst, it's so much easier to learn by looking at the numbers. Because they're always there. There's plenty of numbers too. When you look at any company, you can talk about, this company has return equity of 26.2%. It has grown earnings over the last 10 years. It's at 8.35%. And all these numbers are just there for you, right? Especially in this computer age. But what they don't show you, tell you nothing about culture. They tell you nothing about incentives of the management, about their capital allocation record, about how well they run the business. And so one thing that's universal we're looking for in every company is that we want to make sure the management is good at, first of all, I cannot tell you how much comfort I get when I find a company where the management owns a good chunk of the stock. If the CEO owns 20-30% of the company and they say, we want to make an acquisition, I don't even question it because it's a lot bigger exposure to them than to me. For us, it's a 5% position. For them, it's a 30% of the net worth. Really looking at the how well they allocate capital and how well they manage the business. If there's a large insider ownership, that is just music to my ears. So that would be something universal would be looking for. It's kind of a softer side of analysis we'll be looking for in every company we analyze.
Definitely. And that was actually going to be the next point we were going to hit on where was jumping into managers. So you definitely covered it there. Is there any, inherent risk when bringing in the managers to the equation? I know I've heard past guests kind of argue against leaning into that kind of manager style valuation. Do you have any stance there of it offering a potential risk there for, say, a manager overselling a company?
Question. Well, okay. So I'll give you a couple of things. So first of all, when you talk to management, you have to be very careful. And the reason for this, because if you think about to become a CEO of a public company, You have to have a lot of different skills, but one of the skills, you have to be an incredible communicator. Okay. So when the management communicates, and especially the management that figures out you're a value investor, let me send you the song that you're gonna like. Okay. And you find that the way they talk to you overwhelms your filters. And then you just basically just start buying whatever they're selling you. So I think I'm incredibly sensitive to that. So whenever I find that the manager is a very good speaker, I start I'm not going to hold it against the person, but I'm going to double down and triple down my analysis to make sure that it doesn't influence my analysis. So that's kind of the danger of, in general, talking to the management, right? But, if you're aware of that, if you're mindful of that, then I think it's possible to overcome. I think the insider ownership, I think, is just, it's probably one of the most important things. If CEO owns 20-30% of the company, I cannot tell you that, I would be so much more forgiving and so much more patient with that company, because it's the reason that kind of socialism failed. Because so I'm gonna get off topic a little bit, but it's actually kind of an interesting point. In the 1920s or maybe early 30s, if I get when, in Russia, there was a huge famine. And the reason for that, because the Soviets tried to, you had a village where there was a lot of farmers and everybody had the horse and the cows, etc. And then Soviets come and says, you know what? You don't own anything anymore. From now on, you take your cows, doesn't matter how many houses how many cows you own, how many horses you own, you give it to the collective and everybody owns it. So what happened with basically the production of bread and all the other agricultural products has declined tremendously when that happened, because when everybody owns it, means nobody owns it. So when the management owns the company, owns a good chunk of the company, they really do own it. When they own a tiny amount of shares and they're kind of a full rent CEO, they'll be making decisions that will maximize their pay over that period of time while they're there, even it means the company sinks once they're gone. So anyway.
For sure. And now, I guess, since we dove in deep, kind of getting in on what investing looks like for you, let's pull back a little bit. Overall thoughts on the market, where we're at right now. I won't ask you to do the ill-fated making predictions, but where are we sitting right now? What are you seeing out there?
So it's kind of interesting. I just wrote this article that literally came out an hour ago. And the title of the article is "I Kid You Not Crazy Market." I go through several examples how overvalued things are, viewers can read the article on contrarianedge.com. But let me just kind of give you high level, when you're a child and you just learn how to count, and I'm sure you play this game as a kid where you give a number, you say 10, and somebody says, oh, I know a bigger number, 20. At some point you get to trillions or bazillions. Then somebody says infinity. And then another guy, kids comes in and says infinity times 5. And then he thinks some more. He says, you know what? No, I got a bigger number, infinity times infinity. So the reason I'm bringing this up, because when things get overvalued, you get into this kind of territory, infinity time infinity, because it's very difficult to say you know, like you lose the objectivity in measurement. So it's almost like, I'll give you one example. The way I started out this article, I talked about Coca-Cola, right? And it trades at 30 times earnings. This is a company that it's a tremendous company. It has grown, has not grown earnings and revenues much since 2010. Okay, but this is a company that's an iconic brand and it pays 2.6% dividend. In the environment where investors are starved for yield, they gravitate towards Coke because they're like, okay, there's 2.6% dividend. I don't have to question it. Company will raise it over time if there's inflation. And it's still better than, you know, 10-year treasury that yields, you know, less than 2%, right? The problem is with that thinking is that what happens when interest rates rise? When interest rates go from 2% to 5%, and right now we look at this as almost like an impossible thing to happen. Guess what? The interest rates were higher before when we had a lot less debt. And I'm not saying it's a certainty, but I'm saying it's a probability that's not zero. And I would say it's a probably very high probability that the interest rates will go up, especially when inflation is doing what it's doing today. And if a treasury yield is 5%, then I promise you this, that Coke is unlikely going to be yielding 2.6%. Not because the dividend is going to decline. The dividend may actually increase over time. It's just the price to earnings multiple will decline. And the Coke will come back to where it used to trade in the past, maybe, I don't know, 12 to 15 or 16 times earnings. That means the stock will decline by half. So that's the least craziest of all. Then you go to Tesla, and I wrote the article about Tesla, and I wrote actually this like 30-page analysis of Tesla because I think it's a phenomenal car. I own Tesla, and I think it's a phenomenal car. I absolutely love it. But when it had a valuation of $500 billion, I thought it was insanely priced. Now it's double, so it's, I guess now it trades at double the insanity or double the infinity price. Today's Tesla valuation, basically, if you look at Tesla market cap, which is somewhere between $1.2 or $3 trillion, I forget where it is now, it's worth more than all other automakers combined. And Tesla is making 1 million cars a year. They're making, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 million cars a year. I don't know how many, you know. So, and it's still worth, you know, market capitalization is greater than that altogether. So when you look at that, you say, you know, that's kind of, you know, kind of crazy. But then if you look at GameStop and AMC, you realize, oh, okay, actually Tesla valuation not as crazy because at least Tesla is a company of the future. GameStop sells video games, packaged video games, and they've been disrupted by digital downloads, which we know next year will be more games downloaded and fewer games bought, you know, in packaged than was, you know, this year. And so, and that's a company that has a $10 billion valuation. At its peak, it had earnings of $400 million. Since then, revenues got halved. So you think this company is, you know, has a crazy valuation, but then you look at AMC, and it's even worse. So it's, you know, it's a, you're paying $10-11 billion for a company that has another $10 billion of debt. It's a share count went up 4 or 5x, and its revenues, I don't know, down 70-80% from their highs. And this is a company that barely made any money, like it made a money every other year or so. And the apes, self-proclaimed apes, you know, I'll basically price on it today at $10 billion. So that's even crazier than GameStop. Okay. But it gets crazier than that. So then we get into cryptos and NFTs, right? So let's talk about Bitcoin for a second. So it's impossible to price it. We don't know, like, you know, I have no idea what it's worth. However, I can tell you that in an environment where there is so much euphoria and a limited amount of optimism, its price is probably high. Just considering how much optimism there is out there. But also, you have Bitcoin maximalists who say this is our Lord and Savior. That's the cryptocurrency. But then there are, I don't know, 10,000 other currencies who say, well, Bitcoin is kind of the stone age of crypto because technology is outdated and there's so many other alternatives. So now you have cryptocurrencies. So you have a whole bunch of other alternatives. Which one is going to survive? Have no idea. How much is it worth? Have no idea. Okay. But you think that's crazy. It gets crazier than that because now you have NFTs. And you could argue NFT as a technology may be an incredible technology. But the Ozzy Osbourne from Black Sabbath now is minting crypto bets, and 9,600 of them. My son goes to see Boulder, and he says all of his friends now spending hours and hours instead of being in class on the discourse boards. And here's the rule. If they show their love, how much they loved, those bets, then they get to buy them at the wholesale price so they can sell them at retail. And when they buy, and long story short, if this, they're buying digital art. I'm not sure if it's art or not, but just to flip it to another student, and they'll be bragging how much money they made. If this is not a Ponzi scheme, I'm not sure what is, okay? However, I can tap that. I forget the girl's name, Stephanie, I think Mato. She made $200,000 selling her farts in a jar. That is, and I would argue that the insanity is not that she was selling it, somebody was actually buying it. $200,000 worth. And then she had a medic, and then she, I guess her diet was destroyed by, she didn't have a good diet to keep doing that. So she had a slight medical scare. So now she's back to selling NFTs instead. But my point is, what I just walk you through, kind of different levels of insanity, and I think that's what the market is today. Okay. So that's kind of my overview of the market.
Gotcha. Well, definitely some interesting thoughts there, and things, especially on the digital side, have obviously been escalating over the last couple of months out there. Swinging back to actual investments, we've hit on Uber, we've hit on Coke. Are there any strong investments or things that you've won off of recently, or maybe things that have been brought in with a change of strategy here in the last couple of years that have been great successes that you'd like to highlight here?
Yeah, so a couple of things. I'll discuss them because I wrote about them. So we own pipelines. Like one of the companies we own is Enterprise Products, which is one of the largest pipeline companies in the United States. And what's interesting about pipeline industry, that over preceding 7 years, there was a tremendous overinvestment in the industry. And there was so much capital destroyed that the industry kind of found religion. And now, if you look at the capital budgets going forward, they're minuscule. Okay. So if you think about what happened, so you had a lot of money invested and a lot of projects came online. So cash flows went up while capital expenditures are basically declining tremendously. So, and now they generate a lot of cash flows. These companies have pricing power because most of the contracts have an inflation escalation clause, which only works one way. So that was, if CPI goes up, the pricing goes up. If CPI declines, it doesn't. So they enterprise kind of interesting because I'm going to forget the numbers, but let's say they have $5 or $6 billion of free cash flows, roughly, something like that. They have $30 billion of debt, which is a lot of debt. However, their debt stretches out to 50, 80 years out as well. So not a single year they have a maturity that exceeds $1 billion. Therefore, even if the bond market is closed tomorrow, they can pay off whatever maturity comes their way from the cash flows. And so I think they're yielding right now, enterprise yielding close to 8%, and I think they'll be raising the dividend. It traded like 9 times free cash flows. So like we just talked about Teslas and GameStops and AMCs, and suddenly we're talking, like, so now we're talking about, you know, and by the way, this is not a molten ice cube. We will be consuming, by the way, Enterprise transports mostly natural gas or natural gas liquids, which we use production of cars, whatever. So the point I'm trying to make, like, that's a domain of sanity. That's a like company you can actually analyze, you can value it. Run the speaking of insiders, 25 or 26% of the company is owned by founder's family. So I bet they will not be making stupid acquisitions. So anyway, let's just stick to one example for now. So yeah,
definitely.
Because I'm really looking forward to Q&A.
For sure. And we do have a big old list of questions generated here. More and more have been rolling in as we've been going through things. But we do have one coming directly from our side over on Guru Focus from one of our users, Fred. And he was questioning, what is your thought process for deciding to sell a stock whose price is far outpaced underlying intrinsic value?
Okay. Well, in that example, you should just sell it. Okay. But let me just give you my more kind of my selling framework. So when a company, you sell a company for three reasons. Number one is when you buy a company, we do a huge amount of work. We make certain assumptions what the future will look like. And then the future comes, and for whatever reasons, either we made the wrong assumptions or things, you know, risk happened, future looks different. Then if that's the case, then we might have overestimated the fair value of the company, we'll sell it. Okay, that's one example. Another example is where, let's say we have a full exposure to a certain industry, I'm just, you know, and there's a company, and this, so let's say we have owned the company that's, we think it's a 80 cent dollar. So it's still undervalued. But we found a company that is in the same industry that's a 40 cent dollar. So we may sell one company to buy another. Okay. Now, third example, and this is where company kind of reaches your fair value, and then you figure out what you're going to do. And the answer is going to be different for different type of company. Let's say you have a company that is growing earnings very, very slowly. I'm going to be a lot more less patient with selling, and then maybe selling it in thirds. Maybe I'll be selling one third at 95 cents on a dollar at the, you know, at full value, and maybe it's some above. Just it's a range. Okay. Now let's say I have another company that's a fast growing company, has high return capital, has a long growth runway, and to make things even more interesting, it has a founder or CEO who owns a good chunk of the company. I'll be a lot more patient with selling that and maybe selling it in smaller chunks. And I'll give it much longer leash to this company because the probability of values is so much wider distributed. So.
Gotcha. And then Fred wanted to hit you with the flip side of the coin there as well and ask, are you willing to hold stock in a company if you like the company, but knowing the return might be zero or negative over those first couple of years of ownership?
I rarely know what the return is going to be. I think like return in general, like we look at when we buy companies, can we look at the return we're going to make over 4 or 5 years at least. And so, but when we get it and how we get it, we have no idea. So I rarely have an opinion how it's going to come. So I guess that would be my answer to that question.
Gotcha. And I'm going to go ahead and scroll up to the top of our list now, a decent amount of scroll here over on YouTube, over in the chat. I know I've seen a couple coming in here. Looks like Frank Wang is up at the top of our chat right now. You hit on Uber at the beginning, and it seems like there's some decent interest in diving in a little bit deeper there. Frank's asking, are you worried about competition and cash burn in their Eats business? And it seems like the business is very labor intensive, which is getting a lot of press. Does that cause any worry for you?
Oh God, I should not have talked about it. All right. Could I deflect the question? Not because I don't want to answer it, because I wrote this 12-page article on this. There I go, I answer all these questions.
For sure.
Because it's just, you know, it's a, and you know, so if you go, if Frank goes to contrarianedge.com, there is, I'm looking at the website, and there is a, like, there is a, just a very, you know, kind of lengthy article on Uber. And I would just, you know, if he just, I would implore him to read that. I really don't want to, you know, I would rather not talk about Uber because it would be a 30-minute conversation. So
for sure. Well, we'll keep things at that, Frank. Link will be down in the description there, getting you over there. So make it easy for you to go ahead and find that. He did chime in with another question right after that, though, asking you any thoughts on defense companies coming in, anything looking interesting to you today?
Yeah. So the, I wrote an article about this too, but I'll discuss it. So if you think about geopolitical, like, so in the beginning, we talked about how we look at the macro picture, and we look at the risks, you know, kind of, you know, the, and we look at the risk and try to adjust portfolio. Sometimes you can look at risks and say, I'm just going to be in avoidance mode. Sometimes you say, can I actually take advantage if that happens? So I would look at our geopolitical picture today, and it's probably the worst picture we had in the last 30 years since the end of the Cold War, since Soviet Union collapsed, since I left Russia, basically. And the environment today is that Chinese economy now is almost on par with the United States. You know, some would argue it's larger, depends how you measure it. For a long time, we thought only once China becomes more capitalistic, it's just going to become just like us. And the opposite happened. The more successful it became, the less like us it became. The more it tried to project its power, and the less we. So we are right now. We are incredibly integrated with Chinese economy, thanks to globalization. But this started even before the pandemic. But pandemic actually, you know, accelerated this trend. We're trying to be going through deglobalization, and I think this is very important because. Like we can see this deglobalization if you look at the semiconductor industry, right? The we look at the fact that most of semiconductors are now made in Asia, Taiwan or South Korea, and Taiwan is a huge source of semiconductors. So now TSMC, Samsung, Intel, and others are bringing their, you know, production to Texas or Arizona. So that is deglobalization. So we're kind of going through a very slow divorce from China. It's going to take a long time, and it's not a binary divorce. It's not like tomorrow we don't rely on China anymore. It's going to be very difficult to sever those ties. But we also, this is slowly becoming a fact, but it's over the next 5 or 10 years, it will become almost as a given. That data is becoming new oil. The more data you have, the bigger your competitive advantage is as a country, as a company, et cetera. So China has been using data right now to basically turn the country into, there was a movie with Sylvester Stallone, Judge Dredd. I think it was Judge Dredd, where basically, they could tell everything about you, where you are, because there were cameras everywhere. They monitored everything you do. And that's what China is, kind of becoming a Judge Dredd country kind of thing. And it's, you know, and we want to make sure that they don't, you know, we don't become their subjects like that. So the technology is going through this split, where you're going to have a Chinese technology and you're going to have Western technology. When I, you know, so like when you think about a very simple example is Huawei, which is a largest, one of the largest Chinese companies. We basically, United States and Europe banned their equipment from our country, from our countries. And therefore, because why we did this, we are afraid that they're going to be spyware embedded in their equipment. So, So this is where it gets interesting. Okay, so it's easy to see how US and Europe does that. Okay, India will go with us. Russia will probably go with China. Middle East, I don't know. Probably with the United States, not sure. And then you look at other countries and you try to figure out which, you know, are they getting, so the, you're going to have a technological standards will split. And you're going to have a American standards or let's call Western standards, and you have a Chinese standards. So while that happening, that we also, as Chinese military is growing and becoming stronger, it's going to project its power. So our military and European military will become more and more important. And so we own today American stocks and European defense companies. The interesting part about them, like if you look at them, they still trade at reasonable multiples, maybe 13 times earnings. Maybe, you know, 12, depends on the company, but between 10 and 13 times earnings. They have good balance sheets. They have a customer that will be, you know, that despite the customer's finances, still gonna, you know, gonna write a check that won't bounce. Okay. And it's non-cyclicals, and they have very reasonable capital allocation over the years. So, and if the global conflict, you know, if you're going to see more and more global conflict going forward, then their revenues will only get larger, not smaller. So we also have been kind of adding to, you know, European defense companies, because Europe has been underinvested in defense. And when we exited Afghanistan the way we did, we basically showed to Europe that we may not be necessarily be as dependable ally as we used to be. So UK's, and this happened before the Afghanistan, you know, exit, UK's defense budget last year was up 10%. And I expect that budget, you know, defense budgets for other countries, European countries, will be rising, you know, as well over the years. So that's how defense position explained.
Definitely some interesting thoughts there as well. Hoping to learn coming in next year, asking a big idea question. How do you define quality from a company?
That is a great question. So I'll give you a couple answers. My favorite one comes from Warren Buffett, because it's basically sets your mindset to think what quality means. Would you want to, if you bought this company and the stock market was closed, would you feel comfortable owning it? Would you sleep well at night? Let me give you an example, and I don't want to kind of get into specific of this company, but let me throw your company at you, Peloton. If you buy it today and you could not sell it for the next 10 years, would you be comfortable with that? You know, may or may not be. You know, this can, you know, okay. If you bought defense company, for instance, the answer would be different, right? So that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it, and once you look at it this way, it puts you in the shoes of investor, not speculator right away. Another way to look at it, and we kind of look at it from three perspectives, from kind of three angles. Angle number one, does this company have a competitive advantage? Sustainable competitive advantage. Okay, again, that's kind of the stock market being closed for 10 years fits well, perfectly into that. Okay, so competitive advantage. Number two, does the company have a good balance sheet? Okay. And number three, management. We already discussed management. If all those three things come together, then you have a quality company. Again, it's a very high level, because like a company that's going to has significant competitive advantage most likely going to have high return on capital. You know, that's kind of goes without saying if you have a company that has a good moat. So,
understood. And looking down our list, looks like Sevier Aurora coming in. Looking towards the portfolio side of things, how do you decide on position sizing within that portfolio? Is there an ideal kind of balance in there?
Oh, all right. So, I just actually, it's kind of funny. I just wrote about this. So it's going to be if you really want to get for a very in-depth response, because I did like 2 or 3 page write-up on this, check out, there's going to be a Contrarian Edge in a few weeks. But basically, the size of the position for us will be driven by 2 factors, and we marry them together when we do this. One is going to be company's quality, another going to be company's valuation. Think about it. Let me give you 2 extremes. You have low quality, overvalued company. You probably want to own as little as possible, probably none. On the other side, you have a high quality company that's significantly undervalued. You want to, you know, have a large exposure in your portfolio to that. So we go through every company in the portfolio and give them a quality ratings for every single company. And then for every single company, we give a, we determine fair value. So we actually know how much discount to the fair value there is. And then we measure this too. And that's how we get to, that's how we get to position size.
For sure. And looking down our list, I'm going to go ahead and kind of lump a couple questions together here. 2 kind of key ones here, asking A, and we've hit on this a little bit, who are your investing heroes? And then from there, you mentioned you read a lot. What do you like to read? Where do you look for all this information that you like to bring in?
Oh my God. Investing heroes should be like such an easy question. I always struggle with that one because I just learned from so many different people. And like a lot of my friends are kind of my heroes because I learn so much from them all the time. So I'm not sure I have a good answer for that, so I'll skip that question. However, let's talk about the reading. The older I get, the more diverse my reading became. So I used to read just about investing. Over the years, I realized life is too short. And so I kind of try to expand my reading. So I read a lot about philosophy. I'm trying to think the book, you know, like the latest book I'm reading is about mindfulness. I do read, I'm not even like, it's very interesting. I listen to a lot of podcasts. In fact, I would argue that probably replaces a lot of my reading now, what I used to do, because what happens is that every day I go for about an hour and a half walk, and I just listen to podcasts continuously. And there I listen to Strategery. I listen to Sam Harris's podcast. My God, I have to go on my podcast app to look it up. But I have like probably a dozen podcasts. I listen to Barry Weiss's Common Sense podcast. Just a lot, right? Kind of, Tim Ferriss. I try to expose myself to a lot of different, not just to invest in. I'm sure I've listened to a whole bunch of investing podcasts too, but that actually kind of interesting. I probably read fewer books last year than I had, you know, than the year before. But I probably spend more hours learning than I had, you know, because of podcasts. I mean, I think podcast is just absolutely, you know, very, very important for me.
For sure.
Listen to podcasts.
Definitely. It sounds like that world of information is ever expanding there for you.
Yeah. And you know, another thing is I listen to a lot of interviews on YouTube. So it's kind of interesting. If you ask me what are my most important subscriptions I have, I subscribe to Spotify and I subscribe to YouTube. And I, like, why would you, when I subscribe to YouTube, I have whatever, for $10 a month, when I watch YouTube, I get no commercials. And so I listen to a lot of interviews on YouTube and I love listening to interviews. So that's probably another and very different interviews, you know, or presentations from all the different people.
Definitely. And continuing down our list, it looks like Travis Wood, bringing us back to the portfolio side of things, asking how often do you revalue an investment within that portfolio?
Well, we do it at least quarterly, not revalue, but we get new data and we just kind of update our models. We did, you know, and then when a company starts to approach a fair value, we want to make sure the fair value numbers are still right. But we kind of continuously go through, you know, before we become a company, we build a financial model and we update this models at least once a quarter or as the new information comes out.
Definitely. And it looks like Richard Daly, one of our usual viewers here, chiming in. He's gonna put the nails to you with this one, saying the market seems to be pretty overvalued. Is there anything left to buy out there?
Well, he's the same guy who's asking about McKesson, isn't he? Yes, he's a. So we own McKesson, and I wrote a lot of articles about this. In fact, I think next week we're gonna. My new article is going to come out on McKesson. Richard is asking about Cardinal Health as well. So I would argue that McKesson is a much higher, they're similar businesses on some, you know, on some level, but McKesson is just a better run company. And I'll give you an example. Cardinal Health came out a couple of days ago and said, because of inflation, we're going to take out down our guidance for the year. McKesson CEO did a presentation a couple of days ago after that, a Cardinal announcement. He was asked this question, are you impacted by the same headwinds that Cardinal is impacted? They said, no, we just raised prices. So I can't explain, you know, it's a lot of times I can't explain you why Cardinal is better, McKesson is better managed than Cardinal. But if you look at the historical returns, you can see it in the numbers. So we still own McKesson, and I brought a few articles about this. I think here's the interesting part about it. We bought it 5 years ago. I think it was a $135, $140 stock or so. And we added more when it got to $150. And then they were swapped. And, you know, they got into opioid crisis. So today, this crisis is resolved. Earnings went up from $13, $13, $15 per share to about $23 this year. They could make about $22, $23 of earnings. In the meantime, they also spun out Change Healthcare, and that, you know, that was about another $25 or so per share. So it was a good investment so far, and, you know, it's almost like a double. However, since then, because the earnings went up so much, I would argue actually it's one of the cheaper companies we own today, because we're basically paying 11 times earnings for an oligopoly in the business that will continue to grow because they distribute pharmaceuticals, probably another 3-5% a year. They also have been very good capital allocators. They bought a huge number of shares over the last 10 years. So they can probably generate 8-9% earnings growth. And so if you look 4 or 5 years out, they get $28 to $30 of earnings. So if you think about it, if you put a 15, 17 times multiple, remember Coke trades at 30, then you're easily can get a, 4 or 5 years out, $450 stock. And today it's at 250 or something. So
for sure.
Again, it's not a recommendation. This is just my thinking about the company. I'm not recommending anybody, what I'm recommending, people go and do their own research.
Definitely. And looks like, Bill James coming in here with an interesting question that I haven't seen come up in one of these, asking, how do you handle a retiree's portfolio compared to somebody else who needs cash flow to spend?
Well, we put them all in Bitcoin and that's it. No, we don't. No, NFTs, we buy crypto bets. So we actually have two portfolios. We have a what I call core value portfolio, traditional value portfolio. And about 2 years ago, we created another portfolio, kind of basically focused on dividends. Okay. But the problem is dividend investing, a lot of times it gets you in trouble. The way people are attracted to Coke and say it's 2.6%, et cetera, that's not what we do. We flip it upside down. We select a universe of company of high quality companies that pay dividends. Then we want to make sure that those companies are really high qualities, that they can sustain that, keep paying the dividend. And then we want to make sure they're undervalued. Only if they pass these two undervalued and quality test, then we actually start paying attention to dividend. Then actually dividend comes into the equation. And we also do it not just in the United States, we do it globally, because I think especially European markets, there's still some opportunities left. Oh yeah, and that's where we, about maybe a third of their portfolio today in Europe. And the my expectation for the dividend portfolio, again, I'm just telling you how I'm thinking about it, no promises made to anybody here, is that this portfolio should produce lower returns than our core portfolio, just because in the core portfolio, we're asking for two-thirds of the return we demand from the, those, you know, the dividend portfolio than from our core value portfolio. Though I say this, and about there's probably now 50% overlap between the portfolios.
Gotcha.
So the in other words, in our dividend portfolio, if you're basically saying, I need, the clients are saying, I need income stream and I can accept the volatility, because when you own dividend stocks, you're still going to have volatility. But I hope that these companies will be able to raise prices if, you know, if you have high inflation and the valuation won't, you know, won't contract because we're already buying it as margin of safety. Okay. But again, it's still, they still have to have a long-term time horizon for that portfolio.
Understood. And looks like Sam's coming in here right at the end of things. Another interesting question here that we haven't had, asking you, if you were to create a, we'll call it a self-study value investing syllabus for somebody to go from know nothing to a good investor, what would be your greatest hits for that list? And by all means, feel free to plug some of your own writing here as well.
Well, it's kind of funny you say this, because we actually have that. I created, I wanted to kind of give back to the community, and we created a curriculum of that should help somebody to kind of, you know, to learn about value investing. So if you go to Contrarian Edge and you, and I have to look, I have to find it, but you know, it's a, if you search for the word student, let me do it right now and I'll put it, give it to you. We have this whole student curriculum created just for you. Oh, here it is, value investing curriculum. And I'll put it, how about this? I'll put it myself right now, if I can, in the chat.
Perfect.
Right here. So, Sam, it's just, it's for you.
All righty. Well, there you go, Sam. That should do it for you. And it looks like we are buttoned up right against the end of our time period here, Vitaly. It has been an absolute pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for coming out, answering all these great questions from our audience. Like I said, it's been an absolute pleasure having you out here.
Graham, thank you so much. And guys, thank you so much for watching it or listening, whatever you're doing. And you guys are doing a great job at Kuro Focus. So thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.